Has it become worse? Question mark. Can I still read small print with my right eye? Question mark. And if not, if I had to admit with indescribable terror that my condition had worsened overnight, the blood used to rush to my head, and with my heart pounding I continued to examine myself to see how much worse it had become. Oh Beethoven! In these days I learned to understand your despair when you lost your hearing. You knew the frame of mind, the panic, which comes when one is overwhelmed by the feeling of not being able to stand it anymore, of wanting to flee, to escape from terrible suffering. Yes, but where? My ill luck will always be with me, I cannot get rid of it, I am stricken forever. My despair over the evanescence of life was not enough, I now carried something like an eternal memento around with me to remind me of decay and death. I sometimes felt that those black lines would drive me mad. Never again could I really enjoy myself. My husband did everything to make me forget the condition of my eyes. But whatever he did, however much he pampered me with presents, I could never be happy. Everywhere I looked I saw corruption and death, for I always saw black lines. As the Carthusian monks, who are forced to regard the two letters MM in the palms of their hands as a reminder of the words memento mori, so did the black lines in front of my eyes constantly remind me of blindness and death. If my husband took me to a beautiful spot in the country, I used to think, how long will I still be able to see the sunshine, the mountains, the fields, the sky, in fact, the treasures of nature? If I saw a wonderful performance at the opera, I thought, how long can I still delight in the delicate movements of graceful ballet dancers? Deepest despair, brought forth by the cruelty of reality, had taken hold of me, for my left eye was, if only very slowly, yet definitely beginning to be affected as well. I was therefore well on my way to becoming blind. I could not even cry properly, I had never cried much, for I regarded crying as a senseless means of expression, a form of self-pity which I considered myself to be unworthy of. Now crying was strictly forbidden, for it would have harmed my eyes very much. I bore my despair without any exterior sign, and I never talked about it, for I saw that if I were constantly to talk about my affliction, my friends and acquaintances would suffer as much as I, and consequently, as normal human beings usually try to rid themselves of everything which seems unpleasant, they would drift away from me. I did not want to become disagreeable and boring in my own troubles. On the contrary, I was always gay and humorous, like a clown who hides his deepest sorrows under a painted mask. Thus did I bear my misery in silent suffering. This blow also destroyed my artistic ambitions. Besides playing the piano, I had made great progress in drawing and painting, and my teachers expected a lot in the future. Painting and drawing had always given me much pleasure. Vista now came to an end. When I tried to paint, I saw lots of little black blobs on the canvas. This made me very nervous, and I had to control myself so as not to throw my brush away in anger. I lost my energy and my will to paint. The thought of gaining a reputation and becoming famous only to have to give everything up because of blindness disturbed me profoundly. No. I preferred to give up my artistic career and to continue playing the piano, for I could play blind as well. I practiced with my eyes closed. I walked around the room blindfolded and tried to find various objects. I tried to dress and comb my hair with my eyes closed, so as to be prepared when complete darkness came. I also did this because closing my eyes was the only way of escaping from those aggravating black lines which kept on dancing in front of my eyes. It was my only hope. The salty injections were an equally trying ordeal. Human reflexes are such that the eye closes immediately in the face of possible danger. The eyelids shut instinctively when an object approaches the eye. I had to conquer those reflexes and control myself. I had to keep my eye open without movement and watch, for if the eye is open, one is obliged to watch, whether one likes or not, how the doctor pricked my eye with the needle. I had to go through this procedure many times. I did not know at the time that what I was learning, namely to control the natural instincts, was in fact one of the most advanced yoga exercises, which eventually brings about complete control over all bodily functions. I was forced to do so by fate, and so gained a very powerful grip on my nerves by pure chance. Yet when the doctor saw me to the door after my first injection, I felt very weak and had to pull myself together so as not to stumble and fall. The smile I tried to give him did not come very easily. I felt as if the muscles around my mouth had rusted. And for all my troubles, the injections did not help at all. I stopped going to professors and became more and more pessimistic. The answer was always the same. It's no organic illness, your eyes are completely healthy. It's the lens which is filming over. From day to day my eyesight became worse and worse. What difference does it make if one goes blind with healthy or with diseased eyes? I had to accept the seemingly inevitable. I might have given in. But I could not. How can somebody give up and accept blindness as a normal state of affairs? Immutability and I were fighting against each other. There was no question of my losing. I could not give in, so I had to be destroyed. The night the black line appeared for the first time, I myself was slain. I did not notice it straight away. This amusing, vain, impertinent and sensual little being which wanted to be a famous and celebrated artist and a beautiful woman was destroyed. My hidden philosophy of life, which had been born up on the mountain following my first encounter with death, now took hold of me forcibly. Now I could not, and did not even want to, let the voice, which repeatedly reminded me of the past, go by unheeded. And as I started to listen to this voice very attentively instead of turning away from it, I began slowly to recognize a familiar and dearly beloved voice, his voice. Turning point. One afternoon, I came home from town. The houses in our row stood in well-kept gardens, the sun was shining brightly, flowers were blooming everywhere, birds were singing joyously, and I recalled the words of Don Carlos. Oh, my queen, in spite of everything life is so beautiful. Yes, I felt like adding, if only my eyes were to retain their power of sight. Suddenly I heard the voice in me, asking me quite distinctly, are you blind already? Can't you see the world, the sky, the trees and the flowers anymore? I can, I answered, looking around me, everything is still quite clear. And I remembered what my doctor had said to me the last time I visited him to check up on my eyesight. The right eye has become pretty dim and hazy, but you still perceive more with the other eye than most average human beings with both eyes. Well, if your eyesight is still as good as that, why do you behave so desperately, as though you had already gone blind? Why give up hope? Let us assume that you were to go blind in the second half of your life. If you start giving up hope now, while you can still see quite adequately, your whole life will be blighted by your desperation and your affliction. Quite apart from the fact that you really don't know whether you're going blind or not. Maybe you will die before you go completely blind. In this case, you will have spent weeks, months and years of useless worry, while all the time your eyesight was clear and normal apart from a few annoying black blobs. What a waste of time to worry about events which have not yet occurred. The future? Do you really know what the future is? Events which have not yet come to pass. Why mar your pleasure in life with things which do not exist? Your present circumstances are not too bad. Enjoy life, your chances of recovery will be much better so. Your depressions will only accelerate the destructive process in your eyes. Live in the present. And remember, as soon as your spiritual blindness ceases, your corporeal eyes will regain their functions. Oh, how true are the words of this sacred voice. In the moments of deepest despair, I felt that the black spots in my eyes showed up my interior darkness, my spiritual blindness. But how on earth is one to cure spiritual blindness? For this was the hub of my problems, the fact that I felt completely blind in the face of the secrets of life and death. I was enclosed in darkness, for I sensed death everywhere and could not grasp the meaning of life. I desired to become seeing, it was my greatest wish, but how? And the voice replied, Seek and ye shall find, knock and it shall be opened unto you. I did not understand those words at the time, but I wanted to obey them. I tried breathing deeply and calmly, and concentrating on the present. It was very hard. The black spots kept dancing in front of my eyes and reminding me of my misery, but I tried again and again and reached the point where I felt happy and content again. Indeed, I felt I had to be happy, for my eyes would benefit from my state of mind. I wanted to help myself. I had to be happy, I had to enjoy myself. I began to think about future occupations which would afford me constant pleasure. My husband was very much engrossed in his job. He was a construction engineer, and I rarely saw him except at meals. A thought flashed through my mind, a baby. How long have I wished for a baby? What greater joy could I expect? And I would not be alone all the time. I opened my spirit to the anonymous being which was waiting somewhere to become my child. And the being heard my cry. During my pregnancy, the discharges slowly disappeared from my eyes, and when my confinement came, I had completely forgotten that I had ever had any trouble at all. My memories of lying in the operating theater of a sanatorium, and waking up after an anesthetic, completely exhausted, seem like a long-forgotten dream. I find myself in a form of ecstasy, yet I hear a sound which flashes through me like lightning and brings me back to my senses. It is a cry. Not like the cry of a newborn child, but more like the roar of a lion. It's alive, the thought grips me and a great feeling of gratitude overwhelms me. I open my eyes. A face appears above me and I hear a voice saying, "A boy, a beautiful, healthy boy." I catch sight of a little round head and a fat, rosy body. Is that my child? I ask myself as I gaze at it expectantly. I feel that only its body is my child, otherwise it is an independent being I know has come into being as our child. Then for the first time in its life, the baby lies in a crib, swathed in human vestments, and gazes wide-eyed at the world. My mother and my father have already arrived, waiting to welcome my child and myself after this terrible fight for life. I am at the end of my tether, my heart is hardly beating after my great loss of blood. But the child is alive. After this strenuous experience, my convalescence was very slow. For a long time, I felt very weak, very susceptible to any form of light. The discharges reappeared and the vitreous humor of my right eye became opaque again. Thick clouds of a sort of fog covered my vision in this eye. Yet I never got around to bothering seriously about my eyesight. There was my child. I spent all my time in its presence, and when it smiled at me and embraced me with its podgy little arms, the weight and pressure of my worries seemed far away. The years raced by. My little boy developed magnificently and was admired by everyone for his big blue eyes which radiated so much love and warmth. He was a very precocious child. When he was 4, a scene of my own childhood was reenacted. My child showed me a picture book and asked me the meaning of certain letters. I explained them in detail. The child regarded the letters attentively and suddenly cried, "Mother, that means bull, doesn't it?" I took it onto my lap and kissed it again and again. Then I explained all the other letters. It did not have to learn them. It seemed as if it only had to recall them. We spent the summer together in our family villa near the lake. In fact, a whole series of wonderful summers. My brother and my younger sister invited lots of friends who sometimes stayed at our place for weeks on end. We played croquet, rowed and swam, and in the evenings we used to play chamber music or play games, or dance on the terrace. It was a healthy, happy life. My eyes did not bother me very much during this time. After the birth of my child, I spent some months at the seaside. The secret sources of energy of the sea completely renewed me. I returned home in excellent health and very much more able to stand light. I started drawing and painting again and even took up wood carving. This artistic occupation afforded me great pleasure. On the surface, everything seemed in order. Nevertheless, I was not happy. I did not know why. An inner discontentment grew in me until I could not disregard it anymore. One night, after I had experienced once again the greatest fulfillment of earthly love and unity, instead of falling peacefully asleep, I sat on the side of my bed for a long time brooding over my problems in abject despair. I cried and I sobbed, and in the darkness of that night, I began to examine myself cruelly in order to find out why I was so unhappy and so discontented. I had everything necessary to make a human being happy, from where could my misery originate? This question seemed to call forth the answer. From the depths of my subconscious, the reasons began to ascend and gain consciousness. I was searching for a human being, who was my other half, my complement. Love is the revelation of a power which forces two complementary halves to unite. In fact, the subconscious will to unite is commonly known as love. I had experienced this union, I had attained the supreme fulfillment of body and soul and was not happy, and became more and more unhappy after each occasion. I sat there in the dark and questioned myself in despair, why can't I be happy? I desired an answer and reflected intently. And then I realized that the joy of union was not what I had expected. I had searched for some sort of fulfillment subconsciously, and, having found nothing else, I believed physical love to be this fulfillment. Having experienced it, I had to admit that it was not what I had expected. After experiencing the supreme form of physical unity, I was compelled to see and realize I was looking for something else. But what? I was searching for fulfillment of an eternal nature, a real union which remains. I was searching for a union in which the identity of myself and that of my lover became one in the same thing. I desired to participate in his soul, his thoughts, his whole being. I wanted to become him. But I did not desire what physical unity had brought me. This physical union is a desperate attempt to become one being. Every fiber and muscle is strained to the highest pitch, and in the moment when both believe that they have achieved fulfillment, they fall apart. Without ever attaining union. In the darkness a picture of my childhood appeared in front of me. I remembered sitting at the family table and trying to bring together two little grease spots swimming on top of my bowl of soup. Yes. In exactly the same way as I had tried to unite the two grease spots, years ago, I now wanted to make one being out of our two souls. Out of the two selves I wanted to create a single one. But that is impossible. In love, each lover craves to come together with the other. Yet their craving is merely a physical desire, and they strain against each other in despair. Everybody can observe how two lovers press their hearts together in their fervent embrace. They seem to be compelled to unite their hearts, to be united in their heart. But they fail. Why? Their bodies stand between them. The resistance of the body prevents the union. How strange that I should desire to become one single being with my lover in body and that the body itself should bar my way. Does my body desire this union? Can the body desire anything which is impossible by reason of the very existence of the body? No. The body cannot carry within itself a wish which cannot be fulfilled by reason of its own presence. Who and what therefore desires this supreme union? It can only be the immaterial spirit, the self. And why do I desire this union? Why do I want something which is impossible? I want it because I know that only through this complete concord, this supreme union, will I find satisfaction, and only in this state of mind will I achieve final happiness. This happiness I have been searching for since I began to live. But why do I search for something which is impossible to attain? I do it solely because I know, I feel certain, that somehow it is possible, and that somehow this possibility exists, only I don't know how. What impedes my progress towards my aim? The body. The body stands between us! Therefore, this possibility might exist, but only in a bodiless condition. I long for this lost unison. I once knew it, somewhere and somehow, but I have lost it. Could it be possible that I lived in an immaterial state a long time ago, and that, having been born into this body, I fell out of this spiritual harmony? Is it possible that I once lived in a world of complete unison, a world without corporeal elements, where I lived in a bodiless condition? Having got this far in the logical sequence of my thoughts, I began to feel very afraid. A bodiless state? In a world without corporeal elements? Therefore, in another world? In the hereafter? Could it be possible that this other world really exists? A world, in which I had never believed and which I had always regarded as a necessary invention of a religious nature, used to enforce a moral standard of living among primitive people with promises of heaven and warnings of hell? It is my body alone which exists in our earthly world, and myself, which is cognizant of this impossible union of the flesh and which desires to reinstitute it, does it belong to eternity? If that is so, all human beings originate in another world where this unison is reality, and have fallen out of it into this world, into the material body and an earthly world? Yet the craving for our former happiness lies in us, in our soul, which belongs to this other world. And again we err by trying to attain this happiness, this unity in our body and with the aid of our inherent bodily sexuality. Yet it is the body which itself impedes our success. Oh, now I realize what is meant by the fall from paradise. Therefore I can only reach the happiness I desire in the other world, in paradise. As I cannot force this other world into my own material world, I will strive to get to know this other world where my eternal happiness resides. But how? Empty words are of no use to me. I want reality. I want concrete facts. This night was the turning point of my life. I realized that sex is the greatest of all frauds. Nature promises us a wonderful event, the supreme heights of joy, the embodiment of fulfillment, yet she robs us of our powers. And when we believe we have reached the limits of fulfillment, we fall lower than ever before. We lose a tremendous lot of energy and feel as poor as beggars after the event. An old Latin proverb mentions that both humans and animals feel depressed after physical union. I was looking for eternal, ever-present sublimity, not what sex can give. What is left of sexual pleasure in the morning? Nothing, except possibly great fatigue. And this state of affairs is to repeat itself forever? What else is it but a continuous struggle for unattainable unison? Never will a human being achieve the fulfillment of his strivings, never can he delve into true concord where he can stay forever. Formerly a certain force existed, the power of attraction, which brought together two beings in their search for each other. Later on, this force is appeased, emptiness remains, and each is left alone. Desperately alone, eternally alone. I realized at last, this was not the aim of my quest. And if I was not looking for this, if sex had deceived me, I would refuse to go on in this way. I would refuse to let myself be deceived. Sex can satisfy only the body, but never the soul, the self. Never could sexual satisfaction appease this desire. What now? I must find this happiness. I must search for an answer to my questions. I cannot stand still, I must go forward. But where to? If happiness lies in the other world, I will search for it in the other world. And so I set out to find my happiness and fulfillment where I hoped to discover it, in the other world. Struggle for light. I was trying to capture the world beyond, but I did not know how to set about doing it. I felt like somebody who was trying to conquer a jungle, but who did not know where to start, and whose only instrument was a little axe with which to cut a path through the undergrowth. He knows the jungle to be full of lurking dangers, poisonous snakes and wild animals. He might well lose his way and fall into some abyss. Yet his ignorance of these dangers lends him the necessary courage to penetrate this jungle all the same. I did not know that my voyage of discovery into the other world was going to be fraught with dangers, that unknown forces from the regions of the subconscious would hurl themselves upon me like wild animals, that the wisps would lead me down false trails, and that abysses of madness were lurking on every side. All I had was my little axe, my normal human common sense. Where was I to begin? Religion talks about the life beyond, Yet all the priests I had talked to up to this moment had either wanted me to believe all sorts of dogmas which they themselves did not really understand, or they told me sentimental stories about the kingdom of heaven which they themselves did not believe, but which they deemed adequate to satisfy the little woman. I preferred to find out what the world's great philosophers thought of this tremendously important question, the meaning of life and death. And as I had never heard of great Oriental philosophers, I began to study the works of European thinkers. First of all, I read the ancient Greek and Roman works, translated into a language I could understand. I was enraptured by Socrates, Plato, Pythagoras, Epictetus and Marcus Aurelius. Under the influence of these great men, my mind matured and I learned very much from their teachings. Especially one little sentence of Epictetus remained with me on my voyage like an eternal flame and helped me to cross over from darkness into light. Things are never bad, it's the way you think about them. From the moment I read that sentence, I tried to change my complete frame of mind, my spiritual position, to think differently about things! Yet all these great truths could not supply the answer to my great question concerning the great beyond. Later on I read the newer philosophers, Kant, Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, Descartes, Pascal, Spinoza. None could satisfy me. I felt that they had all gone as far as reason and intellect could take them, but that they had not reached the ultimate goal, union. In fact, they were less capable of answering this question than the ancient philosophers. Among these modern philosophers, Spinoza probably achieved the highest degree in this quest, but I felt that the newest thinkers had somehow entangled themselves in their own cerebral convolutions and come to a dead end. In spite of their philosophical systems, they had remained discontented, disappointed and unhappy men. How indeed could they have helped me find the great truths of the other world? They themselves were ignorant of them and had searched for them as desperately as I was doing. I wanted reality, not words. One autumn day I stood at the window of our apartment with my small son and watched the leaves of a chestnut tree floating slowly to earth. As I had so often done before, I meditated upon the meaning of life and death. Death, I thought. Death again and again. Suddenly I heard the voice in me speaking. Death? Why do you persist in seeing but the one side of truth? What do the trees and nature reveal in spring? Life! Again and again. Life and death alternate in an everlasting circle. Death is but the other side of life. In this moment I saw quite clearly, that as life recedes from the tree and its leaves in autumn, the leaves become lifeless, empty husks, fall off and die. But only empty husks. The essence of life which has lived in the leaves now rests in the tree and bursts forth again in spring, clothes itself anew with a material form and becomes leaves again, repeating its eternal cycle. The tree inhales and exhales life, and only the leaves change, only the outer shell. Life remains eternal, for life is the eternal being. And I saw even further, the fountain of eternal existence. Human beings call it God, breathes life into man, just as the Bible says that God breathed life into Adam's nostrils. Then God inhales again, withdrawing his breath, so that the empty husk falls, the body of man dies. Yet life does not cease at this moment, it clothes itself with a new body, in an eternal cycle and moves on, as everything in this world lives and moves in rhythm, from the orbit of the planets to the breath and pulse of every living creature. Then, in a flash I suddenly remembered how, at the age of 6 or 7 when I first heard about death, I had stood before the mirror, examining the picture of the invisible, my own reflection. Even at that early age I simply could not understand that I would someday have to die, that I would someday cease to exist. I wanted to see where this I was that was thinking these things and did not want to die. I kept looking into the mirror, moving closer and closer until my nose touched the glass. I looked into my own eyes from as near as I could get. I wanted to see this I. Even though there was a black hole in my eye, I couldn't see me. The I, myself, was invisible, just as I had always imagined it to be ever since I first became conscious on this earth. Even in the mirror I could not see me, only my face, my mask, and the two black holes in my eyes out of which I was looking. I felt very clearly that it was impossible for me not to exist. Good, I asked myself as I stood before the mirror. But what will you be looking at the world through when these eyes are someday closed? Through to other eyes. I answered without a moment's hesitation. Here I will close these eyes, and in a new body I will open to new eyes.